Okay, Chevra, last time we learned, we began the second perek of Sukkah, which teaches the halacha of someone who sleeps under the bed in the Sukkah, that such a person does not fulfill the mitzvah of Sukkah. But according to Rabbi Yehuda, apparently you get the mitzvah this way. Rabbi Yehuda says that this is what we did. Now, tonight's Gemara is going to be like a lengthy excursus. We're going to go off onto a tangent about what is necessary to be considered an ohel in halacha, whether an ohel that is not man-made has a status of an ohel or not. And that will be related eventually to our Mishnah. And that's the basic conversation. So most of, or I'd say all of Chaf Aleph Amud Aleph is not really related to Masechah Sukkah, but what's going to happen is on Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, we'll kind of tie it back to what we've learned so far. We'll tie it back to Sukkah. But it's still kedai to do the Gemara, obviously. So let's go. So it's non-hosom. It is 6 lines from the bottom of Chaf Amud Beis. Just wait 1 second. Children make noise sometimes. It's non-hasam. So the Mishnah teaches us in Maseches Ohalos. The basic halacha of ohel is if you have a mace inside the same area as other people, things, whatever becomes tamei. That's one halacha of an ohel. There's another halacha of an ohel that an ohel protects tumah on top of it. If something, if the tumah is inside, is encased, so then the stuff on top of it is not going to become tamei unless it's what is called tumah ritzutza, unless it's like squashed tumah. If you have less than the tefach between the mace and the ohel, so in that situation, the tumah goes up and up and up and up. It goes tumah ritzutza's ola ad l'rakia. It goes all the way up to the shamayim. That's the basic halacha. So it's not hosam. So we learned echad shecharuhu mayim oshratim. If you have a hole, shecharuhu mayim. What's charuhu mayim?
Eroded with water, carved out with water.
You know, it's carved out with water, right? It's like the Medrash about Rabbi Akiva walking by, and you know, you see the drop, drop, drop. So the water basically makes this into a ohel. The water makes it an enclosed thing. Oshratzim, or you have some bugs that dig it out. Rashi comments the shratzim are choldos and ishos. I believe a chold is a weasel and an ishos is a mole. Right? That's how you dig it. Osh achluhu malachas, or it is consumed by some salty water. The salty water over time builds up, builds up, builds up, and it makes the makes into an ohel. B'chein mad b'chavonim. Similarly, if you just have an overhang of stones, b'chein su'ar shel koros, or if you just have beams that jut out. So in this case, ma'el ala tumah. That all these things, according to the Tanna Kamma, are an ohel for purposes of tumah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ko ohel she'ino asui bidei adam, eino ohel. Right? This is going to be the Rabbi Yehuda that we're going to keep in mind for this entire page of Gemara. Rabbi Yehuda says that an ohel that is not man-made is not an ohel. Ohel, by definition, has to be something that is man, right? We'll add for this year, or woman that made, it is made by humans. That is the definition of an ohel. And therefore, if you have an ohel that was made because the water carved it out, or the like, or the animals carved it out, so that is not considered an ohel. My time, it's Rabbi Yehuda. The Gemara says, going over to the top of the next page, what's the reason, Rabbi Yehuda? Yalef ohel mi mishkan. K'siv hacha zos ha-toyra adam ki yamos ba-ohel. U'k'siv hasan ba-yifros es ha-ohel al ha-mishkan. Malahala bide odom, afka bide odom. The Torah in Parshas Chukas teaches me the halacha of ohel for tumah. Zos haTorah odom ki yamus ba'ohel. Right? That the halacha of tumah sets in when a person dies in an ohel. So the word ohel is used. And the same term ohel is used by Yifros Esa ohel aha mishkan that Moshe Rabbeinu himself, the Pesukim tell us in Vayakel, Moshe Rabbeinu himself built the Mishkan. Vayifros Esa ohel aha mishkan that Moshe put it up. Zach the Gemara, or Zach Reb Yehuda, Malahalam bidei Odom, Afkan bidei Odom. That just like the Mishkan was built by a human, just like Moshe Rabbeinu erected the Mishkan himself, and that's why it's called an Ohel, so here also, in order to be called an Ohel for Tumah purposes, we're learning some sort of Gezeirah Shava, of Ohel, Ohel. So to be an Ohel, it has to be Asui Bidei Adam. It has to be man-made. What to the Chacha? Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Rabbi Schwartz. How are you?
Baruch Hashem, I'm okay.
Great. I had a question about the boards. It the seems board. Like the boards, though, have some kind of person-made element to them, don't they?
So I think, right, I was bothered by that, Kasha. I thought you would ask the Kasha when we got to it. Like Sorash or Koros on Chofam and Beis, like there are these beams that stick out. So obviously it's man-made. So I think the idea is that it's not just the issue of man-made versus not man-made. The real issue at hand is whether it was done intentionally.
Doesn't Rashi suggest it's done intentionally? I thought he said that they were in a pile, didn't he?
Right. One second. So they
Zeh
are...
Gabze.
That you have the beams which are put on the ground, one on top of the other, and they are there to build stuff. And there's a lot of holes between them, and it's considered an ohel. So according to the Tanna Kamma, it's an ohel. According to Reb Yehuda, it's not asui bidei adam. What Reb Yehuda means that it's not asui bidei adam is Reb Yehuda feels that to be an ohel, it has to be something that is intentionally made. And these Sohar Shel Koros, even though you're right, if I understand your question correctly, you're saying, what do you mean? But the Sohar Shel Koros are man-made, right? People take the beams and they put them down. The answer is that no, that's not considered man-made for these purposes, because what we're really talking about is whether it is intentional. Right? If something is made by a human, but it just happens on its own, it's not constructed with intent, that is also not considered man-made for these purposes.
When you say intent, you mean intent of what?
To make an ohel. I mean intent that I want it to cover something underneath it. I want it to be an overhang. So I want the stuff underneath it to be protected. So the Chachamim disagreed with Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda learned ohel, ohel from the Mishkan, that it has to be asui bidei adam. How come the Chachamim disagree? Right? Presumably Rabbi Yehuda has the upper hand. As of now, he has his Gezeirah Shavah. So the Gemara says, V'rabbanan, ohel, ohel, riba. What does that mean?
It says ohel multiple times in that pasuk, which it actually says it three times in the pasuk, and we were a little confused by this interpretation.
Well, zos haTorah adam ki yamus ba'ohel kol ba'el ha'ohel b'chasher ba'ohel yitmah shivat yamim. So ohel, ohel, right? Rashi comments, since it says ohel many times, this includes even an ohel that is made on its own. I would have learned the Gezeirah Shavah, that to be an ohel, it has to be man-made. But I have lots of times when it says ohel in the context of tumah, which means that for tumah purposes, it can be an ohel even if it's not man-made. That, I think, is what the Chachamim are saying. This, of course, leaves open the possibility that even according to the Chachamim, if you have an ohel that is not tumah purposes, So maybe it has to be man-made in that case. But I don't think the Gemara says that at all. I think what the Gemara is really assuming is that the Chachamim are saying, Ohel, Ohel. It says Ohel many times by Tuma. And this teaches me that the Chachamim hold even a non-man-made Ohel is also an Ohel. That's really what's going on in the Gemara. Okay.
Are we clear on how they're, like, what we were confused by when we were learning this is that it seems like the Chachamim's argument makes a lot of sense if it's Ohel twice, and it's actually Ohel three times in the Pasuk. Does that matter? Like, do we care about that? Or
I don't think we're learning from two as opposed to one. I think what we're saying is that the fact that the Torah uses the term Ohel many times teaches me that not only the paradigmatic Ohel, that's Asui Bidei Adam, is called an Ohel, but even another form of Ohel, even a non-man made Ohel, is also an Ohel. I think that's what the Gemara is getting at. Again, you're bothered by 2 versus 3. I just don't know if that's significant for our purposes. So the Gemara then asks, "V'savar Rabbi Yehuda, ko ohel she'inu asui b'adam, eno ohel, does Rabbi Yehuda hold that to be an ohel has to be man-made?" Uraminahu, we're going to ask a question from a Mishnah in Meseches Para. Now, here is the thing about Meseches Para. Here is the thing about this Mishnah. The Mishnah basically sounds like too weird to be true. I don't know if you remember when I was a kid, there was a show on TV, Ripley's Believe It or Not. Anyone remembers this? Right? And it just can't be true. And like you read this halacha and it's like, what the heck? No? So basically what they did is that women in their 9th month when they're about to have a baby, this can really scare women not to have babies, but they would take them to these big rocks, and the rocks would be situated in such a way that there certainly is a tefach, is open space between the rock and the area on top of the rock. So therefore, there can be no tumah that goes up. And they would have their babies on top of the rock. And they would raise the babies on top of the rock until the time that the babies are like age 7 or so. And these babies would be involved in the making of the Parah Aduma process. And they would take these babies and they would bring them to the Shiloach. And we'll talk about in details how they get them to the Shiloach and how come they don't become Tameh that way. They bring the babies down to the Shiloach. And these, I mean, not babies, they're little kids already. And these kids, like our Para Aduma squad, right? I guess they have like a big pay or something on their chest. You know, it's like the big Para Aduma squad. It's like so cool. Like all the kids wanted it. And the Para Aduma squad would help fill up the water for the Para Aduma process. That's what's going on. So we have an unbelievable amount of chumras that are thrown into the Parah Aduma process. Right? And the Mishnah in Parah that we're going to be talking about is about all of these chumras that Chazal instituted in the Parah Aduma process. So first let's learn this Mishnah in Parah with the Gemara. We'll talk about Rabbi Yehuda. And then we're going to ask the big question of why. Like, why on earth would you come up with these, you know, pardon, nutty chumras that just like, who would believe it? So, I mean, no, we have a fun question. Chatzeros hayubinuyos Yerushalayim agabe hasela. They built court cards in Yerushalayim on top of rocks. V'tachtehen chalal. And underneath them is empty space. Mipnei kever hatahom. Because there is a kever hatahom, or we are worried that there is kever hatahom. There is a concern, a suffix that we would call in Yiddish very far-fetched, that maybe there is some corpse that is buried directly underneath this courtyard. That's the concern. So because of that, the entire city, Rashi comments, they're worried that maybe there are graves everywhere. And therefore, we're also worried that the tumma will be tumma ritzutza, worried that the tumma might go all the way up because maybe the tumma is squished inside. So to prevent all of these issues, they would raise the children on top of rocks where there was a space of a tefach under the rock. So any tumma that would be there would for sure get contained and the tumma not go on top. So they have these courtyards on top of rocks. And they did this, they kever hatahom. They did this because maybe there are dead bodies there. By the way, this concern of maybe there are dead bodies is also relevant in this week's parasha, Parashas Noach. There's a din that there's tumah in Eretz Ha'amim. Maybe Ikar Adin, the Kohen, is not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael because the assumption is that Chutz La'aretz is all tumah. Why is Chutz La'aretz all tumah? Because the assumption is that the Meisei Mabul are all buried all over the place. So Sima, you got it easier because in Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara says, Rashi quotes Al Hatayra, that the Mabul never got to Eretz Yisrael, no?
Is there Tumas Meis by a non-Jew?
So is there Tumas Meis by a non-Jew? So the answer is yes. Whether there's Tumas Ohel by a non-Jew is a Machlekes Patanayim. We paskin in Shulchan Aruch that there is, that a Kohen should not be in the same Ohel as a Meis. But you're right, according to those opinions, by Yochai or whatever, that there's no Tumas Mace, there's no Tumas Ohel. Everyone holds there is Tumas Mace by Yogai. Everybody holds that a Kohen is not allowed to touch a corpse. But when there's Tumas Ohel, Zamachalika Satanayim, right? Odom ki yamas ba Ohel, Atam kriyam Odom, Ve'in Akam kriyam Odom, however we sugarcoat that one. But the basic idea is that this halacha of Tumas Eretz Ha'amim seems to be going along the lines of those who assume that there is Tumas Ohel for Goyim, because the Meisei Mabul, those who died in the flood, are not Jewish. Oh. So what they do is, the women go, and they give birth on top of rocks, and they raise their children over there for Parah Aduma. They raise the children over there for Parah Aduma, and they keep the kids there until the boys who they're going to use for Parah Aduma are the age where they can become Tomei with Valkeri, until the age that they might have a seminal emission, which Chazal says is around the age of 8. Okay, grand. Tysus is bothered by Akasha. But one second, if you want to keep the kid Tahar, so we got a problem, because every woman, when she delivers a baby, she becomes Tumeya Alts Tumas Yoledes. So every baby who's born is Tame, because the baby is born from a mother, and the baby is touching the mother, so there's Tumas Yoledes, it transfers. So Tysus basically answers that we're not nervous about that type of tuma. Touching the tumas yoledes is not really a tuma that's chamura. We're nervous about tumas meis, and we're nervous about tuma that's called tuma hayotze olav megufo, tuma that comes out of the body, like balkeri, etc. Those tumas we're nervous about, but we're not nervous about other forms of tuma. Right? That's the Tosis umevi and nashim ubros viyoldos. Right, if you look at that Tosis very quickly, Tosis says afal pishayat yinokis tumei and benida viyoldas. Still lo hayu choshishim ela shomim mitumas meis debaya hazaya umitumay yotsim migufo kigon balkeri. Right, in other words, they're only nervous about these super duper chomer tumas. Right, that so they have this whole process of raising the babies on the rock until the kids are age 8. And what they do with these kids we call them the pay brigade, because they are there with their para aduma emblazoned on their t-shirts. Umevian shivarin, then they bring oxen, the algabehem dlasus, and on top of the oxen they put doors. The tinokos yoshvin algabehem, and the kids sit on top of the doors on top of the oxes. They bring these fat oxen. The oxen, I think, came from Mitzrayim. Oxen from Mitzrayim are super duper fat. They would bring the oxen and, one second, you'll see, just close the door. They would bring the oxen and they would put the door on top of the ox. And the kids would sit there. When they would take the kids and bring them to the Shiloah. Tinokas Yoshin Agavim, the Kosos Shul Evan B'Yedehem. The kids are holding stone cups. Again, because of the entire Chumra of Para Aduma, they want to use Kalim, which are not at all susceptible to Tuma. So they use clay avonim. So they're going to fill up the Para Aduma water with stone Kalim. Higil Shiloach, when they get to Silwan, right, the Mei Shiloach down at the bottom, that's where they get the Para Aduma water from. So Yardu Toch HaMayim U'Mil'um V'Olu V'Yashvu Lahem. What they would go is, they would go down to the Shiloach, right? They'd like jump off the oxen for a minute or jump off. I can imagine the kids would consider this a ton of fun, no? Imagine you're like a seven-year-old kid. Isn't this like the most fun in the world? I should ask my son. He'd probably, I totally agree. This is like the best thing ever. You get to sit on a door on top of an ox. You get to the bottom to Shiloach, you jump off. You fill up the water, then you jump back up onto the door on top of the ox. Right? This is the system. According to the Tanakhama, they would jump down. Reb Yossi Omer, Mimekomo Haya Mishal Sheol Umimalei. Reb Yossi says that they would lower the cup with a rope. Mimekomo Haya Mishal Sheol. They would lower the cup down, umimalei, and they would fill it up that way. In other words, the kids would not even get to jump off the doors on top of the oxen. Now, this entire thing is done mipnei kever hatahom. But mipnei kever hatahom is the explanation of this entire din, the entire Mishnah in Parah that says that the kids, the babies are born. By the way, you think maternity wards are like not so much fun, right? You're giving birth to a baby on top of a rock, on top in a courtyard, right? This is kind of Dr. Tanner. Would this go over in? It's perfect, right? Most sanitary thing ever. I mean,
what's a little weird to me is not the giving birth part, which is confusing, but how they raise them there.
Right, so it's the labor and delivery room, and then it becomes your home for the first 7-8 years of the kid's life. And they raise the kids on top of these racks. Yeah, it's really weird. They're raising the kids on top of the racks. Okay, now there is a machlokes. This entire din is based on kever hatahom. That's what we said. But there is a machlokas whether they would fill up the water by dropping the kid down into the Shiloach, having the kid jump off the door, or whether they would just lower the cup with a rope of some sort. Rashi explains, here, let me just finish for a second, Zoe. Rashi explains that this machlokas is about whether you need miloi biyad. Right? Rashi writes, if you look at the Rashi, it's like four lines before the lines get wide. Rashi writes, "Kosavar haitana milui be'inon velo sheyishal shel bechevel." Right, the opinion that says that you drop the kids into the Shiloach says that there is a halacha that you have to actually fill up the water yourself. If you drop the pail of water down on the rope, so technically, you're not doing the maisa milu. You're not filling the cup up. It's happening on its own. The opinion that says that the kids have to fill it up on their own holds that you need a maisa milu, that you have to fill it up yourself. That's why Rashi learns the Gemara. Tosfos says that this is not correct. A Tosfos that begins Yardu. Tosfos proves in many Mishnayos that everybody holds. There's no halacha of miloy biyad. There's no such din that you have to fill up the water with your own hand. Rather, the machlokis as to whether they would fill up the cup while sitting on top of the doors, on top of the oxen, whatever, right? That machlokis relates to how nervous are we for kever hatahom. This concern, right, which we said is a far-fetched concern, that maybe there's some corpse underneath it. It's technically possible that underneath the shiloach also there's some corpse. Are you worried that in the 30 seconds that you're going to drop the kid down into the shiloach to fill up the water, that maybe the kid's going to end up on an area where there's a kever hatahom? So according to Tosfos, that's the machlokes. That the opinion that says that the kid sits on top of the door, on top of the ox, etc., is saying, oh, you can't even go down for a second. Kever hatahom, oh, right? That's the way, that's the issue. Zoe, I cut you off before.
No, it's fine. We had a question as to like why a door specifically, like what is that? We have a theory that a door stops tuma, but we weren't really sure.
I don't know if a door stops tuma, but a door is a door that's not mekabel tuma. A door is a plain piece of wood. There is a halacha, Gemara's in Baba Basra, that kol davar hamekabel tuma is ino chotzeitz b'fnei hatuma. Anything that can become tuma itself cannot serve as a barrier for tuma. So were they to bring a piece of metal, so that piece of metal can become tummy itself, and therefore it would not be able to be a barrier and to prevent the tumma from going through. But they would bring doors, again, a door meant a plain piece of wood. That's basically what door means in this context. That's the way I understand it. Okay.
And it just, I guess it's a little off topic, but can a girl do this ceremony, like a child?
Honestly, I do not know enough about Meseches Parah to answer that question.
If we're talking about Baal Keri, then...
Not for a girl, right? In other words, for a girl, you could raise them there until they would potentially become needles, let's say at age 11 or something, or right, whatever it is. I don't know. I do not know the answer. You probably have to do research in Meseches Parah. Again, it's obviously not Mitzvah Seisha Asman Grama. Is there some Gezeiras HaKosav somewhere that says men, not women? I just don't know.
I feel like that'd be really sad if, you know, you put all that effort into giving birth on the rock and then you were voted off the island. Darn it.
Okay, let's go on. So let's just actually maybe pause over here for a second. Why exactly did they put all these chumras in place by Parah Aduma? Right? They're doing everything in a way that we know for sure there's no tuma underneath it, and everything is done with stone. Why do they have all these chumras in place? So Rashi over here has kind of a lengthy explanation. Rashi begins with Mevi and Noshan Ugros. Rashi writes that Mishuma Hidnan Metamen Hoyuas Hakoin Hasorif Sapora Umapilan Oso Miyad Vahotzi Milibon Shal Tzedukim Shayomer Bim Urave Shemesh Haisanaases. Okay, it goes like this. There was a huge machlokes between the Perushim and the Tzedukim about how you do Parah Aduma. Ordinarily, if a person is tummy, so the person goes to the mikveh, but that person, after he went to the mikveh, after she went to the mikveh, could not eat truma and kachim until nightfall. But that's like the first Mishnah in Brachos, right? That you have to wait until nightfall, right? Until you can eat truma, kachim, stuff like that. Until nightfall, between the time that you went to the mikveh and nightfall, you would have something, you would be called in halacha tavo yoma. Tavo yom means you went to the mikvah during the day. Now the tzedukim said that because the entire para aduma process has to be done b'tahara, so therefore you cannot be involved in the para aduma process until Harav Shemesh, until the sun went down. The rabbis disagreed vehemently with the tzedukim. Apparently, if you want to know something that tore Klal Yisrael apart, this was it. The rabbinic Judaism took the approach that we do para aduma process even with tevo yom. And not only did the Chachamim say even with tevo yom, but to show that the tzedukim are wrong, they dafka did it with a tevo yom. So every time that they did a para aduma in history, they would dafka take a kohen. The Mishnah writes that metamin hayu es hakohen, right? If you read on in the Rashi, it's not. The Mishnah in para gimel, Mishnah zayin, metamin hayu es hakohen asarfas hapara umat bilan oso miyad lahotzi miliban shal tzedukim. They would take the kohen who's going to do the para aduma process. They would make the kohen tame. They'd say, here, kohen, kohen, here, touch this nevela, become tame. They would make the kohen tame. Then they would dunk the kohen in the mikvah. And then the moment the kohen would come out of the mikvah, they'd say, kohen, do para aduma, even before Harav Shemesh, even before it gets dark. And they would do that specifically, lahotzi miliban shal tzedukim. Because the tzedukim held, we only do para aduma after it's dark, the chachamim would say, we're going to do para aduma dafka with the tevo yom. The cave on the tevo yom, kosher b'para, asu b'maylos harbe, kidei shelo yizal zaluba. This is like the key point in Rashi. Because there is a kula that is thrown into the para aduma process. The kula is that they do para aduma with a tevo yom. Because of this kula that they're using a tevo yom, so therefore we are worried that people might not consider para aduma serious enough. The people might be lenient with para aduma. So therefore the Chachamim instituted a whole bundle of chumras to offset that one kula. That is what's going on over here. The reason why you're raising the kids, right? Tamar is like, okay, I understand, give birth on top of the rock. Who's going to raise kids on the rock, right? You're raising kids on top of the rock. You're doing everything with stone to make sure it's not tummy. The reason for that, Zucht Rashi, is in order to add chumras to offset this one kula that we dafka do, para aduma al yedei a tevo yom. The story is as follows.
So then Rashi would be assuming that they only followed this whole procedure during the time of the tzedukim, but so, not necessarily previous.
Yeah, probably. Again, it's unclear exactly when Sedukim lived, when they began, when they ended. Right, but the Mishnayos that deal with Para Aduma, right? There was a Para Aduma b'mei Moshe Rabbeinu, right? I think the Mishnah says there are like 7 Para Adumas in history. So Para Aduma b'mei Moshe Rabbeinu, probably they didn't have these chumras. They only have it lahotzim liban shel Sedukim once they're at Sedukim. Fair. Now, the story goes as follows. The Torah, when it speaks about the paraduma process, it says, V'hiza ha-tahar ala-tame, that the tahar person sprays the ashes on the tame person. The word tahar is usually written tes he vav resh. In this context, in the Chumash, it says tes he resh, the vav is not there. That led the Chachamim to say that it is someone who is tahar, but not fully tahar. It's tahar without lavav. It's like partially tahar, and that's why they are using a tevul yom who is partially tahar. But to emphasize that their drasha is correct, they dafka use the tevul yom, and because they're dafka using a tevul yom, they have to have additional chumras that are thrown into the miskeret. Rav Schechter, in his sefer on Parshas Chukas, a couple of years ago, one of the students of Rav Schechter, Alan Weissman, began publishing Rav Schechter every week. He would ask us to vote what we wanted to learn on Thursday, either to go on in the Gemara, or to do Mishnah Brura, or to do Parasha. And when he would give Parasha Shir, it'd be like all over the place. So in Parshas Chukas, I forget which year Alan Weissman took the notes from, that when he published his book, Rav Shechter, that sefer from Parshas Chukas, says that we see from Chazal that there is always a certain balancing act in the calculus, that when we have too much of a kula, we also have to add chumras into the miskeret to balance things off. We don't want people to, God forbid, view an area of halacha as less than fully serious. The other example that Rav Schechter gives to this is as follows. The case of classical aguna. Classical aguna is different than what we call aguna today. Today we call aguna when there's like some jerk of a husband who doesn't give his wife a get. But classical aguna is a situation when the husband went missing. So we need edus to verify that the husband is dead and the woman can remarry. Ordinarily, whenever we need eidos for gittin, kedushin, to begin marriage, to end marriage, you need two eidim. Al pishnayim eidim yachum dover. The only thing is that apparently at one time, the chachamim felt that there are too many people who got lost at war or something. It was unclear exactly why. But they looked into the psukim and they realized, you know what, we're going to be makal that eid echad is mutter lahatir aguna. That even a single eid can testify that an aguna is permitted. Even a single eid can testify that the guy is dead. That's a tremendous kula. We're using one eid instead of two eidim. Even, right, people who are ordinarily not kosher for eidos, right, noshim, right, avodim, goyim, that when they are mesiach lefitumo, a goy who is just saying something matter-of-factly, we accept the testimony in all these cases by an aguna, because it's such a serious matter, we have to relax the normal rules of, again, Chazal are relaxing the rules, not just like, oh, we gotta have a kula. They're relaxing the rules because they darshan from psukim, or they have svaras on the level of deraisa to relax the rules. There's like five shittas in Rishonim, exactly what the reason for the kula of eid echad by aguna is, but that's the kula, it works. Well, here's the thing.
Rabbi Schwartz, it's very interesting how you're framing it as if they're being mechadesh or diraisa rather than saying it's like some mesora that is like an asmachta or whatever.
I'm just saying it the way Rav Schechter says it. Sometimes there are dinim d'oraisa that were only uncovered at a certain point because of a historical event that forced them to uncover it. Amoni v'lo amonis, mo'avi v'lo mo'avis. Was a din d'oraisa. But until the episode of Boaz and Rus, and until there's a whole fight about whether David is kasher l'malucha or not kasher l'malucha, they didn't realize that that's a drasha. The drasha existed.
Wasn't that a Kabbalah? I actually remember this from Yavna.
It's a Kabbalah. But it's a Kabbalah that like one person had in like a tradition of based in a Shmua HaRamosi. It wasn't well known, but at some historical point in time when David wants to become king, they're like, oh, we got to look around. Oh, and they found it. They found that old man in the back of the shtiebel who's like stroking his beard. And says, I have a kabbalah from Shmuel. Right? That I'm only Velo Amonis. Right? That's the way I imagine the story. He probably said it in Yiddish, not in English, but what can we do? But the point is that the Chachamim at some point in time felt that they had to relearn the sugya and come up with a kula that Eid Echad is Neman by Aguma. Rav Soloveitchik apparently felt that to assume that Chachamim come up with kulas because historical circumstances forced them to look into the sugya is an absolutely fine thing in the realm of halacha. Some students came to the Rav and said there's a professor in Jewish Theological Seminary who said that the reason why Chachamim are mekel, that you don't need four complete walls by a sukkah, that you could have two walls for Shlishas Afilu Tefach because there's some shortage in wood in Eretz Yisrael, and that forced them to do it. Rav Soloveitchik said, okay, that's not apikorsis, because you could say that you derive halachas, like, because, right, there's some expression for this in English, right, that necessity is the
mother of invention.
It's the mother of invention, exactly. So you come up with something, you're forced to it, that's why they came up with it. Oh. So here's the story. Just like we see by Parah Aduma, that because there is one super duper kula that they use a tevol yom, so they also have a ton of super chumras that are thrown in to balance it off. So by Aguna also, because we have this super kula of Eid Echad, they threw a chumra into the miskeret called Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Mayim She'en Lahem Sof means that if someone, a husband, falls off of a boat in the middle of an ocean, Mayim She'en Lahem Sof means that you can't see from one end to the other. It's mamesh in the middle of a big body of water. So you're not ne'eman to be matir aguna. In all likelihood, let's be honest, the guy's dead, no? The boat capsizes in middle of Atlantic. In all likelihood, the guy is dead. No, mayim she'en lahem sof, we're machmir, we're not matir and aguna. The Gemara has like one far-fetched story about a guy who fell off of the boat and he ended up grabbing onto some daf shel sfina, he ended up grabbing onto some board and he like rode that board to safety and he ended up on the shore. I remember one year at the Siyam Hashas, Rabbi Yisachar friend read this Gemara because the Gemara finishes off the line that the daf, hitzilosi, the board of the ship saved me. So my friend is such an awesome speaker. He's like, the daf saved me. How many of us could say that we were saved by the daf? He's awesome. So there's a halacha of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof. Mayim She'en Lahem Sof is a huge chumrah, but it's there in the misgeret in order to offset the kula of Eid Echad. That's the way Rav Schechter understands these sugyas. It's all based on this piece that he has in the Sefer is all based on our Rashi that we just learned. That by Parah Aduma, we have chumras to offset the kulas. There also, you have a chumra of Mayim She'en Lahem Sof to offset the kulas. It happens that Mayim She'en Lahem Sof as a chumra rarely comes up. The Pesachei Teshuvah there in Eben Ezer, Simen Yud Zayin, it's like the longest simen in Eben Ezer. It's all the dinim of being Matan Aguna. Pesachei Teshuvah says that Mayim She'en Lahem Sof that we're machmir on is only when there's one rove. But if there's two roves, we're mekel. In other words, when there's one rove, a guy capsizes in the ocean. So rove is very strong rove. A rove could be like 90%, 95%. But there's a rove that the guy is dead. But let's say there are two roves. Let's say, for example, you're in a boat and there's a fire on the boat. And then you don't find the guy. So it's a double rove. Rove of the people stuck in a massive fire are going to be dead. Rove of the people who are in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean are going to be dead. If there are two roves, you can be mekel on agunas. The basic yesod is that the Chachamim have always, throughout history, we've worked so hard to be makel on agunas, and we use two robes. It happens at the year of 9/11. I was in the Kol HaElyon in Yeshiva, and we were learning this part of Yevamos. We're learning the end of Yevamos about the heter of agunas. Those are the sugyas that the Kol HaElyon was learning that year. And like we all thought that we're going to be talking about lamdis, our luck, whatever, at the beginning of the year, the World Trade Center comes down. And we were dealing with Aguna Shailas in a Halacha L'maisa sort of way. And we use this two-rove thing very often, right? As long as you can construct two roves, rove of the people above this floor are definitely dead. And rove of the people who didn't come back within this amount of time, etc. As long as you can construct two different roves, right? And like, I remember every morning in the Beis Medrash, there was like a bezdim, like in the front of the Beis Medrash, Rabbi Willig and Rabbi Schechter and Yonah Reis. And they were working together and they were accepting Eidos to be, they were working with like, they used to, I don't know what people would do now, it would be much harder. But people used to buy monthly Metro cards and you could track what station you swiped at what time. And if I think the first tower was hit like at 9:01 or something. So the assumption is that if you swiped at like 8:53 and it's a 4-minute walk from that train station to your office, and then the elevator takes you have to make all these cheshbonos about where the guy was, et cetera. They were make on all those cases because there's rove, etc. Again, these cases are not really mayim shein lamsof cases necessarily, but even by mayim shein lamsof, lamaisa were make of their two roves. The only reason why we're talking about this, again, is because Rav Schechter uses this Rashi here for the halachic calculus that when we have super kulas, we have to have offsetting chumras to balance the miskeret. That's basically the idea. Okay, questions, comments on this point? Excellent. So now let's just go back to what we're up to. The opinion of the Tanna Rabbi Yehuda is that in order to be an ohel, it has to be man-made. If it happens on its own, it's not an ohel. Then we quote this Mishnah in Para about how they would raise the children to Tahara, and they would take the children over to the Shiloach on top of oxen, on top of boards, their boards on top of oxen, and they would lower them down, etc., etc. Vitanya, and we learned, it is around halfway through the page. Vitanya is the word before the last word of the line. Vitanya, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says that they didn't use the door thing. They would bring oxen. They didn't use doors, they would bring oxen. So the Gemara says, one second, according to Rabbi Yehuda, they're bringing oxen? V'hashivarim da'ohal she'eno asui bidei adam hu. Rabbi Yehuda, you hold that in order to be an ohel, it has to be asui bidei adam. So the shor itself, let's say the shor, the ox is an ohel. You don't think of an ox as being an ohel. But when you realize that like it's 10 tefachim off the ground, it's like a flat thing on top. It's like a big ox, right? So the Gemara says, one second, how could that be an ohel? According to Yehuda, a shor is not asui bidei adam. So how does that work? Uksani Reb Yehuda omer lo hayimavim zlasos ela shvarim. So the Gemara has a steer in Rabbi Yehuda. On the one hand, Rabbi Yehuda says that to be an ohel has to be man-made. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda says that the oxen count as an ohel. Which one is it? So the Gemara answers, Ki osir Rav Dimi, Amir Rav Elazar, Moda Rabbi Yehuda, Kimlo Egrov. Rabbi Yehuda is maskim, he agrees, if you have something that is very wide. Mlo Egrov, it is much larger, it's larger than a tefach. It's like the size of a fist. Ordinarily, the shear of a ohel is one tefach. An egrof is larger than that. Zuck the Gemara. When Reb Yehuda says that to be an ohel, it has to be also a bidei adam, that's only an ohel of a tefach. But if it's a wide ohel, if it's melo egrof, so then even if it's not as wide as a tefach, that counts as an ohel. And that is how we explain Reb Yehuda. Reb Yehuda, although he holds that ohel has to be also a bidei adam, nonetheless, they could bring the kids on top of the ox. They didn't need to use doors. They'd bring the kids on top of an ox itself. Aye, the ox is not oil, also bidei adam. The answer is, yeah, but the ox is really zafting. It's a fat ox. It's more than a tefach. It's melo egrof. And once it's melo egrof, so therefore Rabbi Yehuda agrees that it is that is going to be chotzit me'atum. It's considered an ohel. Tanyanam hachi. We have a brisa also. Umod Rabbi Yehuda b'shakifin b'nekike hatzla'im. Rabbi Yehuda agrees that by shakifin and nekike hatzla'im, these are like rocks that fell down and they make a big hole, that these things count as an ohel. Aye, it's not asui bidei adam. The answer is, it doesn't have to be. Since it's like very wide, it does not have to be asui bidei adam. So then the Gemara says, okay, grand. So far I got it. We're saying that according to Rabbi Yehuda, an ohel has to be asui bidei adam, unless it's very wide. But hare delas, the yesh b'kama egrofen. Uktani Rabbi Yehuda omer, alayim mevin zlasos elo shivarim. One second, if you hold that something that's very wide counts as an ohel by definition, so why does Rabbi Yehuda say not to use the door? The doors are very wide. So Rabbi Yehuda should let you use the doors. How come he says that you don't have to use the doors? So you can use the ox itself. Why does Rabbi Yehuda say lo hayim mevin delasos? It's very wide. Now, of course, and Tysus raises this issue, this entire kasha is what we would call a red herring. Because the whole discussion within Rabbi Yehuda is when it's an ohel that's asui bidei shamayim, when it's not man-made. The delasos are man-made. No? You put the doors on top of an ox with the intention of making an ohel for the kids to sit there. So really, this whole Gemara, the Kasha, is very hard to understand. But whatever it is, they were asked, but the delasos are very wide. And how could Rabbi Yehuda says you don't use it? So Amar Abaye, lo hutzruchu lahavi delasos. Abaye interprets Rabbi Yehuda saying, you know what, you don't have to bring doors. Lo hutzruchu lahavi delasos. Rava Amar, lo hayu mevin delasos kol ikar, shebet nesha dato shel tinok gasa olav, shema yotzi rosho echad me'ivarav v'yitma bekever hatahom. Rava says that they would never bring doors. You see, according to Abaye, what's going on over here is that they didn't have to bring doors. If they wanted to bring doors, they could. Rava says you can't bring doors because, says Rava, the door is very wide. The kid's going to get all cocky when he's up on top of this door. And the kid's going to say, oh, wow, you know, like, look, mom, like one hand, no hands. Remember like the way you rode a bike as a kid? Look, no hands. And you end up like hitting a car, then you end up in an emergency room, right? Yeah. So that's the concern, but not the kid's going to end up in the emergency room because the door is so wide, the kid's going to like have a good time. He's going to bend over and wave. And we're worried that when the kid's going to bend over, the kid is going to end up being ma'ahil al-o'ah-ketahom. The kid will end up being an ohel on the kever hatahom. So in order to solve that problem, we don't want the kid to get too cocky, etc. So we don't bring a very wide thing. So Abaye and Rava have a machlokes. According to Abaye, if you want to do doors, you can, but you don't have to. Reva says, don't bring doors, because I'm worried if you're going to bring a door, the kid might get cocky and might become tummy. So far, so good, Chefer? Now, there is a discussion which we'll probably have to have next time that Tosfos raises, which is how on earth can you say that there is an ohel to protect the kid on top of the ox, or the kid on top of the door on top of the ox, chad gadya, right? How can you say that there's an ohel when in halacha there's a principle that ohel zarach lo shmei ohel, a movable ohel, an ohel that moves, doesn't have the status of an ohel. So this is what we're going to have to talk about next time. And it will lead us to a conversation about like Kohanim flying over cemeteries and airplanes and stuff like that. Just because these are cool topics of conversation. And if you ever saw the pictures that people, every like 6 months, like Facebook and Twitter repeat. Right? So every 6 months you have a picture like some guy, how come he's like wearing a plastic bag on the airplane? No, he's like, well, in case, you know what I'm talking about? Like, okay, you Google, right? Chassid and plastic bag on airplane, right? You'll see what I'm talking about. So Blee Nedder, we'll talk about that next week. Okay, ladies, any questions, comments, observations, jokes?
Just before, this is like very specific to me, but about the non-Jews having tumat mate or not, does that have anything to do with the fact that when we are in anatomy lab, we're told that the cadavers are mostly imported and that like we should assume that whoever we're working on is not Jewish?
So that's one of the reasons for it. In other words, that if it's non-Jewish, so according to some Rishonim, so there's no Tumas Ohel, but there still is Tumas Maga and Masa. And as a Kohen going to medical school is very difficult halachically. One of the main reasons, though, why they tell you that the cadavers are non-Jewish is because of the concern for Nivul Hames, that we're supposed to treat bodies with respect. It needs kavura, etc. So the assumption is that these dinim of Nivul Hames only apply to Jewish cadavers, not to non-Jewish cadavers. It happens that the Ramban al HaTorah has a chiddush where he says that Jews have to be buried. We assume that there's a din d'oraisa of kavura. The din d'oraisa does not apply to non-Jews. However, in Eretz Yisrael, the Ramban writes like on the pasuk v'lo titameh es aretzachem, you have to bury even non-Jews. And the Ramban says that's why the pesukim in Sefer Yehoshua say that after Yehoshua killed the 31 kings, he would take them off the gallows and bury them. He wouldn't leave them hanging up there. In Eretz Yisrael, there is a need for kavura. So the question about medical school in Eretz Yisrael, etc., is a real question. Although, in terms of Nivul Hames and kavura, you'll have to forgive me if this gets a teeny bit graphic, but there's a machlokes haposkim about how much of a corpse has to be buried. You probably don't have a complete corpse there, no?
No, we do, but we save everything. And then at the end of the year, we're planning to, they bury, that's what they told us. At the end of the year, they bury everything, including any organs or anything that we took out.
So. Okay, so that's the idea. In other words, that the assumption is that there is a mitzvah, they're following that Ramban, there's a mitzvah of kavura even on non-Jews because it's an Eretz Yisrael. There's a lot to be said about these topics. These are not fun topics, but you live with this. Like, wow, anatomy lab, awesome. There used to be a TV show called Gross Anatomy or something, which is like really gross. No? Okay, whatever. Okay, Rachel, yeah.
I didn't follow this whole discussion about Rabbi Yehuda's opinion about man-made. What did that have to do with the Mishnah?
We're not there yet.
Okay.
Next week, we'll... This entire conversation, that's how we began tonight. This entire conversation is going to be an interesting conversation about man-made ohels, non-man-made ohels. And next week, we'll bring it back home to discuss...
Oh, okay.
to how it connects to Sukkah. Yeah, Zoe, you had a comment?
Very quick. Are we only concerned that the tinok is going to be exposed to like an avatuma?
We're only concerned that the tinok will be exposed to tumas mace,
right?
Or to tumah hayotze migufo,
and that's right? It.
That's it. In other words, that's what Tosfos comments. The fact that the kid is tummy anyway, because the kid was in contact with his mother when she gave birth, etc., that we're not worried about. And the tum of Nevelon Sheretz, we're not worried about. But you can have shrutzim on top of rocks.
Right. That was what I was asking.
Right? And the Sheretz is an avatuma. But we're only worried about tumas meis and tumah yotzeh migufo. Okay, Chevra.
Also, Tanya made a joke to me as a chat that instead of saying a red herring, you could have said a red heifer.
Okay.
You asked for jokes.
Not bad. Thank you, Tanya. Much appreciated. Okay. Chevra, have a great Shabbos, and we'll continue to be in touch.
Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Thank you.